This demoralization resulted from social conditions, which had perhaps developed more unfavorably in Africa than in other parts of the Roman Empire. The free peasants had long ago become the serfs of the great landed proprietors, and were little superior in position to the masses of slaves who were everywhere to be found. And the great landowners had become, in their turn, easy victims of the policy of extortion followed by unscrupulous governors to an increasingly unprecedented extent in proportion as the dignity of the imperial power sank lower. No man who had anything to lose would now take a place in the Senate of the large towns, which had once been the goal of the ambitious, for the senators were required to make up all deficiencies in the revenue, and such deficiencies were now frequent and considerable. Bloody insurrections repeatedly broke out, always traceable ultimately to the pressure of taxation. Manifestly, the Vandals came in as a positive relief to such a system. They exterminated the great landowners, wiped out all debts to Roman moneylenders, and abolished the last vestiges of military service. The cultivators found themselves better off. The minor officials kept their places. It wasn't so much a conquest as a liberation from an intolerable deadlock. It was while the Vandals were still in Africa that a great leader, Attila, arose among the Huns. The seat of his government was in the plains east of the Danube. For a time he swayed a considerable empire of Hunnish and Germanic tribes, and his rule stretched from the Rhine into Central Asia. He negotiated on equal terms with the Chinese emperor. He bullied Ravenna and Constantinople for 10 years. Honoria, the granddaughter of Theodosius II, emperor of the Eastern Empire, one of those passionate young ladies who cause so much trouble in the world, having been put under restraint because of a love affair with a court chamberlain, sent her ring to Attila and called upon him to be her husband and deliverer. He was also urged to attack the Eastern Empire by Genseric the Vandal, who was faced by an alliance of the Western and Eastern emperors. He raided southward to the very walls of Constantinople, completely destroying, says Gibbon, 70 cities in his progress, and forcing upon the emperor an onerous peace, which apparently didn't involve the liberation of Honoria to her hero. At this distance of time, we're unable to guess at the motives for this omission. Attila continued to speak of her as his affianced bride, and to use the relationship as a pretext for aggressions. In the subsequent negotiations, a certain Priscus accompanied an embassy to the camp of the Hunnish monarch, and the fragments that still survive of the narrative he wrote give us a glimpse of the camp and way of living of the great conqueror. The embassy was itself a curiously constituted body. Its head was Maximin, an honest diplomatist who went in good faith. Quite unknown to him, and at the time to Priscus, Vigilius, the interpreter of the expedition, had also a secret mission from the court of Theodosius, which was to secure by bribery the assassination of Attila. The little expedition went by way of Nish. It crossed the Danube in canoes, dug out of a single tree, and it was fed by contributions from the villages en route. Differences in dietary soon attracted the attention of the envoys. Priscus mentions mead in the place of wine, millet for corn, and a drink either distilled or brewed from barley. The journey through Hungary will remind the reader, in many of its incidents, of the journeys of travellers in Central Africa during the Victorian period. The travellers were politely offered temporary wives. Attila's capital was rather a vast camp and village than a town. There was only one building of stone, a bath constructed on the Roman model. The mass of the people were in huts and tents. Attila and his leading men lived in timber palaces in great stockaded enclosures with their numerous wives and ministers about them. There was a vast display of loot, but Attila himself affected a nomadic simplicity. He was served in wooden cups and platters and never touched bread. He worked hard, kept open court before the gate of his palace, and was commonly in the saddle. The primitive custom of both Aryans and Mongols of holding great feasts in hall still held good, and there was much hard drinking. Priscus describes how bards chanted before Attila. They recited the verses which they had composed to celebrate his valour and his victories. A profound silence prevailed in the hall, and the attention of the guests was captivated by the vocal harmony which revived and perpetuated the memory of their own exploits. A martial ardour flashed from the eyes of the warriors who were impatient for battle, and the tears of the old men expressed their generous despair that they could no longer partake the danger and glory of the field. This entertainment, which might be considered as a school of military virtue, was succeeded by a farce that debased the dignity of human nature. A Moorish and Scythian buffoon successively excited the mirth of the rude spectators by their deformed figures, ridiculous dress, antic gestures, absurd speeches, and the strange, unintelligible confusion of the Latin, the Goth, and the Hunnish languages, and the hall resounded with loud and licentious peals of laughter. In the midst of this intemperate riot, Attila alone, without change of countenance, maintained his steadfast and inflexible gravity. Although Attila was aware, through the confession of the proposed assassin, of the secret work of Vigilius, he allowed this embassy to return in safety, with presents of numerous horses and the like, to Constantinople. Then he dispatched an ambassador to Theodosius II to give that monarch, as people say, a piece of his mind. "Theodosius," said the envoy, "is the son of an illustrious and respectable parent. Attila likewise is descended from a noble race, and he has supported by his actions the dignity which he inherited from his father Munzuk. But Theodosius has forfeited his parental honours, and by consenting to pay tribute has degraded himself to the condition of a slave. It's therefore just that he should reverence the man whom fortune and merit have placed above him, instead of attempting, like a wicked slave, clandestinely to conspire against his master." This straightforward bullying was met by abject submission. The emperor sued for pardon, and paid a great ransom. In 451, Attila declared war on the Western Empire. He invaded Gaul. So far as the imperial forces were concerned, he had things all his own way, and he sacked most of the towns of France as far south as Orleans. Then the Franks and Visigoths and the imperial forces united against him, and a great and obstinate battle of Troyes in 451, in which over 150,000 men were killed on both sides, ended in his repulse and saved Europe from a Mongolian overlord. This disaster by no means exhausted Attila's resources. He turned his attention southward and overran North Italy. He burnt Aquileia and Padua and looted Milan, but he made peace at the entreaty of Pope Leo I. He died in 453. Hereafter, the Huns, so far as that name goes in Europe, the Huns of Attila, disappeared out of history. They dissolve into the surrounding populations. They were probably already much mixed, and rather Aryan than Mongolian. They didn't become, as one might suppose, the inhabitants of Hungary, though they have probably left many descendants there. About 100 years after came another Hunnish or mixed people, the Avars, out of the east into Hungary, but these were driven out eastward again by Charlemagne in 791-5. The Magyars, the modern Hungarians, came westward later. They were a Turco-Finnish people. The Magyar is a language belonging to the Finno-Ugrian division of the Ural-Altaic tongues. The Magyars were on the Volga about 550. They settled in Hungary about 900. But we're getting too far on in our story, and we must return to Rome. In 493, Theodoric, a Goth, became king of Rome, but already for 17 years there had been no Roman emperor. So it was in utter social decay and collapse that the great slave-holding world ascendancy of the god Caesars and the rich men of Rome came to an end. Sixth. But though throughout the whole of Western Europe and North Africa the Roman imperial system had collapsed, though credit had vanished, luxury production had ceased, and money was hidden, though creditors were going unpaid and slaves masterless, the tradition of the Caesars was still being carried on in Constantinople. We've already had occasion to mention as two outstanding figures among the late Caesars, Diocletian in 284 and Constantine the Great in 312, and it was to the latter of these that the world owes the setting up of a fresh imperial center at Constantinople.